We continue the shiur in Gemara. The Gemara says, any person who does not learn Torah, neither Chumash, nor Mishnah, or Gemara, is not considered civilized. That person is not considered a civilized person because there are two categories, a category of man and a category of animal. Only the Jews that study Torah are included in that category of man. Others who do not study Torah at all live like animals, meaning that they provide only for their body and not for their neshama. Gemara says, too, that a person that doesn't study Torah is actually pasul for a witness. He cannot testify in court because only a person, the man, can testify in court, and he is not in that category. The Gemara adds, speaking about civilized people, anybody who walks outside and eats in the middle of the street is comparable to a dog. Therefore, he too is pasul for a witness. He cannot testify. What is the sin of eating in the street? Here Tosafot says that it is possible for a person to have a small bite of something, let's say a piece of candy or fruit in the street, without being considered uncivilized. But for a person to wash for bread and then to go outside and eat the bread in the street, that person is actually comparable to a dog. The explanation of this comparison, why does the Gemara specifically pick the comparison of dog? Because the Gemara tells us that Gemara Shabbat says there is no one, nothing that is poorer than a dog. He is an animal who is cursed. It's difficult for him to find, for it to find food. We find every other animal can find its sustenance easily. Stray cats always find enough food to exist on and maintain themselves. A dog who is left out without an owner generally fades away. He starves. I'm not speaking about those dogs who are domesticated. Those dogs who are kept in homes, they do not lead a dog's life. Although that's because they are in this mad world today, we find that people seem to have adopted dogs as part of the family. And it's in such a ridiculous manner that dogs are accorded the same privileges as children in these places. And these people who do that themselves have lowered themselves from the category of person too. They have not elevated the dog to the category of human. They have descended themselves to a category similar to that of dogs. But I mean, the average dog is not associated with that type of people, is that hungry that he starves. Now here the Gemara says that this person who eats in the street is comparable to a dog, meaning that he deserves to starve, and that he will starve. Why so? Because we are taught, the Gemara Pesachim says, that any person who ignores, disrespects the value of bread, meaning that he allows crumbs to fall on the floor, he's not careful, extremely so, of crumbs, that person is punished with poverty. It's the greatest curse that can befall a person, as far as his livelihood business is concerned, is if he shows a disrespect, bizui, it's disrespecting and shaming food, specifically bread, bread crumbs. There's a special shed, evil spirit who's appointed over crumbs to avenge the disrespect to these crumbs. Now, here, the penalty for that, of course, is poverty. So here, the Gemara says that this person eating in the street, there it's difficult or practically impossible to be careful about crumbs that fall, stray crumbs, to avoid showing disrespect to them, to have people step on them. When a person is at home on the table, he's not that careful, because he knows that after he's finished eating, he will then clear off the table very carefully of the crumbs. But out in the street, he cannot do that. That means he ignores the edict about being respecting bread. Therefore, his penalty is poverty like that of a dog. Therefore, too, the Gemara says that he is pasul, he is unfit to serve as a witness in court. The Gemara adds, too, speaking about people who are subnormal, a person who is a habitual kasen, one who is in kas, loses his temper easily. What does that person gain through his kas, through his anger, through his evil temper? The Gemara says a person like that could never win any battle with his anger. The only thing he has to show for his anger is the anger itself. meaning the toll it takes from the person's health. A person who is angry, has an evil temperament, automatically is too has a high blood pressure. He suffers physically, but there is no gain whatsoever by anger. Therefore, the Gemara says that aside from the fact that kas is like avodah zarah, spiritually it's so sinful, even physically the person must be a fool to allow himself to fall victim to this evil tendency of anger. The Gemara says that a person who gets married says to the chatan, says to the kala, "Harei at mikudeshet li, you are hereby mikudeshet, sanctified to me, you become my wife with this ring." That's a straight statement from the chatan to the kala. With this statement, she is then married. There's no question or doubt about this marriage being legal. But there is also a marriage that's given on tenai, condition. If he says, "You are my wife," on condition that a certain thing is fulfilled or that a certain thing exists, she is not married to him until or unless that tenai, that condition, is fulfilled. The Gemara says, what if a person whom we don't know exactly how wise he is, how learned he is, says to a woman, "You are hereby my wife on condition that I am a chachem, I am very learned." Now, how is that condition to be fulfilled? How much wisdom must he have in order to make this tonight, this condition fulfilled, that she should be his wife? The Gemara says that when he says that, it doesn't mean he must be as learned as Rabbi Akiva or as the rabbis of the Gemara. To fulfill that condition, a chacham means only, simply, that he has enough wisdom to be able to answer any question on any topic that is asked. Any Gemara that he's asked about, he should be able to answer. That's simple, of course. It's not that simple, knowing every Gemara. But knowing it means not the way the great, the wise rabbis of the past knew it. He should have a general knowledge to be able to answer generally any question asked in any Gemara. The Gemara says, what if he says on condition that I am a gibor, I am powerful physically? How strong must he be in order to have this marriage consummated, legalized? The Gemara says he's not required to be as strong as Avner ben Ner or Yoav ben Tzruya, the generals of Shaul and David HaMelech. Avner ben Ner was so strong, his burial place, by the way, is directly opposite the cave of four couples, there at the Machpelah. He was so powerful, the Gemara says, that an army could not budge his leg. He stood his ground. An entire army could not move him. So this person who says, on condition that I'm a gibor, it's not to be as strong as him, how strong must he be? Strong enough to have his all his friends afraid of him because of his strength. And if they are afraid of him, they fear him because of his strength, then this marriage is a legal one. What if the man says, on condition that I am a rich man? How rich must he be? Not as rich as Rabbi Elazar ben Charsum, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, who was so wealthy that they had cities that belonged to them, entire cities, tremendous possessions and wealth, but only enough that the people of this person's vicinity respect him for his wealth. They consider him wealthy and respect him for his wealth. This constitutes being a wealthy man. The Gemara says, now, a different case. If a man says, "You are my wife on condition that I am a tzaddik," now what do we do? The Gemara says, she is married. No questions, regardless of what he is, she is automatically married to him. At least enough to require a divorce before she can be free to marry anyone else. Which means that at least she is safek mikudeshet. Safek, she remains in doubt whether she's married or not, at least, so that if she's in doubt, and certainly she cannot marry anyone else till she gets a divorce to free her. But we say that she is married because even if we are positive that this man is a complete rasha, still we judge him for the good. We say that when he made this statement, and probably he did teshuvah at that second, at that moment when he said it, if he did teshuvah, all his sins are erased, and he is a tzaddik. Therefore the marriage is legal. What if the man says, "You are my wife," on condition that he says, condition that he is a rasha? What happens then? The Gemara says again, regardless of what he is or who he is, any person who says that, she is married. Because even if he is a complete tzaddik, perhaps at that moment when he said that, he opened his mouth and allowed that word to come out, maybe he is now a complete Asher. How does a complete Tzaddik switch to become an Asher in 1 second? Simply by thinking of Avodah Zarah. A doubt, faith of Hashem, at that moment, makes him a complete Asher. So therefore, in these two last cases, there's no yardstick to measure what completes this condition. Any person who makes these statements is considered married. Now the Gemara tells us that when the world was created by Hashem, there descended from heaven certain items, characteristics, that were distributed among the people in the world. Now, for example, wisdom is something that comes from heaven, something that a person does not have to strive for necessarily. He studies to gain additional wisdom. But there are some people who are born wise, born sharp minds, and some who are born with very dull minds, which means that this wisdom came from heaven. Hashem sent down from heaven 10 measures of wisdom, 10 tenths of wisdom. We consider it in tenths. Of this wisdom, Hashem doled out 9 tenths of all the wisdom in the world he gave to Eretz Yisrael. The seat of wisdom on earth is Eretz Yisrael, to the extent not just the people living there are wiser and sharper than people outside of Eretz Yisrael, but also even the air itself, the atmosphere of Eretz Yisrael, is that holy that a person breathing that air becomes wiser than before. That's what the Gemara says, Avida the Eretz Yisrael Machkim. The air of Eretz Yisrael gives wisdom to the person breathing it. To what extent is Eretz Yisrael wiser? 90% of all wisdom in the world is in Eretz Yisrael, and the rest of the entire world has to share the remaining 10%. The Gemara says that from heaven there descended beauty to the world. That means material or physical beauty. Of this beauty, Hashem gave 90% of it, 9 tenths, to Yerushalayim. The aesthetic beauty of the buildings, the edifices, the architecture, one can see that it's different than the rest of the world. The actual Nof, it's called, which means the panorama. Seeing Yerushalayim, you can detect a difference between that beauty and anywhere else in the entire world. So that only 1/10 of the beauty that remained had to be shared by all other lands, countries in the entire world. Then the Gemara says that wealth was sent down to the world. Now, this wealth, 9/10, was given to the Roman Empire. And of course, only 1/10 to the entire world, remaining 10th to the world. Roman Empire today is centered in the center of Rome, or what we call the Vatican City. There is that much wealth there. Plus, the wealth, too, has rotated a lot, going from one country to the next. The Gemara in Pesachim describes that, how this wealth moved about. And the Gemara there says, too, that president came to rest in Rome. The rest of the world has to share what is left of that wealth. Going deeper, of course, the Gemara says that wealth itself is not too meaningful. It depends upon what the person does with this wealth. So we cannot judge gold by its weight. It's by what value it is to a person and what he does with it. Materially, though, the Gemara says that it is a fact that 9/10 of the wealth was given to the Romans. And we know here, too, that the Gemara speaks about things that are only measures given from heaven. We do not say that measures of goodness or evil came down from heaven. This is not decreed by heaven. This is something that comes from earth itself. A person, before he is born, there is dictated about him in heaven that he will be wealthy or otherwise, healthy or otherwise, or he'll be wise, or he'll have a dull mind, but heaven does not determine whether he'll be good or evil. This the person does for himself during his lifetime. Yemina says that there are magic, of course, we don't have it today. At the time that magic existed, magicians existed, 9/10 of all magic existed in Egypt. That was the center of magicians and magic, and only 1/10 remained for the rest of the world. Of the diseases that came to the world, 9/10 of these diseases was given to the pig. so that the most unhealthy food that exists is pig's meat. All other diseases comprise only 1/10. Everything else in the world is only 1/10, and we find elsewhere where the Gemara says that the pig is always filthy. The mouth of a pig is always filled with filth. That's why most diseases are there. 9/10 of zanut, the evil of zanut, is 9/10 of all the zanut in the world is found. The rest of the world has only 10% left. So that all pornography and the like add up the entire world's zanut of all types, it's only 10%. The other 90% is found. Though an outward appearance, it seems that they are very zanut, very modest. Women go dressed completely covered from head to toe. Actually, the truth is that they have 9/10 of all zanut. Now there's a power of, very important power, element of speech, power of speaking, which elevates a person above that of an animal. So that speech is very valuable. Of all the speech given to the world, women took 9/10 of all speech, and men remained with only 10%. That's why we say, too, that a man is not complete. He's unmarried. He's got to get his mate, because the Adam is a chai, that means a behemah, and there is Adam, person. What is the difference? Adam is called medabir. The power of speech raises him to a level above that of animal. But if he is not married, he's called only chatsi guf, half of a person. When he's married, that his entire organism is completed. The one unit, original unit of these two souls, half souls, which are really one. The reason there is to become a complete Adam is so that there'll be the unity, the combination of all 10/10 of speech. So a man gets married in order to receive the amount of speech that he's missing. The result in many cases, sadly, is that he does not get the other 9/10, he loses his 10th to his wife. She takes all of it. In some cases. Jimenez says that the evil of drunkenness, of drinking too much, alcohol, 9/10 of this the Kushim took, and 1/10 remained for the rest of the world. 9/10 of sleep was taken by the slaves, servants, 1/10 for the rest of the world. These are all measures that whether it affects a person himself or not makes no difference. It's important to know, that is, how much of it he's got. It's important to know, though, which one is good, which one is evil, and how a person should strive to stay away from those that are bad as much as possible and to acquire the opposite tendencies. Or if they are good, he should strive for them. And then the Gemara continues in that vein, too, by telling us that one of the most important qualities a person can possess is being reserved, refined, and polite. Therefore, sitting at a table where a platter of food is placed on the table for all to partake of, then those who are tsnuim, that means those who are reserved, polite, they don't reach out for it. They contain themselves, keep their hands away from the plate, let the elders take first, let the others serve themselves, and then they go last. This is the polite way. The gadi gadanim, is those who are uncouth, they reach out quickly. They grab for the food. Now, there's a Gemara called Masechta Derecheretz. Derecheretz means to respect, character. And the Gemara says there, a story of Rabbi Akiva. Here we see how students are taught this politeness. Rabbi Akiva invited two of his students to his home for a meal. He had the appetizer put on the table. And then the rest of the food. Now, this appetizer consisted of a stalk of cabbage. It's a heavy cabbage stalk. He placed it on the table. One of them, the polite one, reached out for it, and he tried to remove the head part of the leaf from this cabbage stalk. It was very tightly attached to the stalk. It wouldn't go. So he dropped it and went on eating his bread and waited for the rest of the meal. The other one wasn't that polite. Tried it, didn't work, so he held tightly to the cabbage with both hands, to the stalk, and With his teeth, he tried to rip off a leaf of this cabbage. Rabbi Akiva saw this, and he said to the student, "That's not the way to do it. Why don't you put both feet on it, hold it down with your feet, and then you can pull it off with your hands?" In other words, it was a dig, but a very sharp one, insulting one, to teach him politeness and manners. And this, of course, is what the Gemara stresses here. The polite person is one that will allow others to precede him in reaching for food or anything else on the table, and will conduct himself with manners that are fit for a person who is refined. That's why the Gemara says, too, that Derecheres Kadmela Torah. Before you can go on deeply into Torah, you must first learn respect and manners. The Gemara tells a case of Rav Gidel, who is very anxious to buy a certain plot of land. And he was discussing the purchase with the seller, with the agent. Meanwhile, while he was in the midst of this negotiations, Rabbi Abba went and bought this land outright. It means Rav Gidel lost his chance. Rav Gidel felt very bad about it. He went to Rabbi Zeda, Rabbi Yitzhak, to complain about this, to charge Rabbi Abba with unfair practice. If you see someone else is negotiating for something, for the purchase of something, you're not supposed to go behind his back and buy it quickly. So Yitzhak said, "Wait until he comes. Wait until Rabbi Abba comes. Let me hear his side too. Let's not condemn him or convict him. Let's see what he says." Now, next holiday, Rabbi Abba came to visit Rabbi Yitzhak, and Rabbi Yitzhak asked him, "What if a poor person is trying to get a certain item of food? Is it proper for someone else to grab it while he's trying to get it? What would you say about that person?" Rabbi Abba answered, "That person is called a rasha, a wicked person." Yitzhak asked him, "In that case, then how come that you bought the land when Rabbi Gidel was negotiating for it?" Rabbi Abba said, "I'm sorry, I had no idea that he was negotiating. It was done unintentionally." Rabbi Yitzhak said, "Well, then why all this problem? Why don't you just return it, give it to him? Let him sell it to him." Rabbi Abba answered, "I cannot do that. It's impossible for me to sell it to him now, because this is the first plot of land I've ever bought in my life. And we know that it's very bad for a person's mazal to sell the first thing he ever buys. Therefore, I cannot sell it to him to spoil my mazal, my luck, for the rest of my life." This is not a superstition, of course, Chas v'Shalom. This is something that the Gemara says is excluded from the items of superstition. The person has a full right to abide by this. So Rabbi Abbas said, "I cannot sell it, but what I could do, if he wishes, I gladly give it to him as a gift." And the result was, the Gemara says, that Rav Gidel refused to take this land, because the Pasuk says, "He who hates gifts lives long." We can understand the opposite from this sentence. A person wants to live long, then to avoid gifts. Rabbi Abba refused to take this land now because of the fact that he felt he was not justified in keeping it. It should have belonged to Rav Gidel. So neither of the two went down to cultivate this land, and it remained hefker, ownerless, free for the other rabbis to enjoy, take the crops from. Here again we learn ethics, morals on the part of the rabbis. Note how strict they were in morals, that Rabbi Abba, who had paid for the land already, but because of the fact that Rav Gidel had wanted it, he now refused to own it. Rabbi Gidel refused it because, also as a matter of ethics, he said, "I would not accept a gift. If it's mine, it's mine only when I pay for it." And these are the ones who set examples for their students, for us to learn how to act, to emulate them, copy them, and their character, their ethics and morals. Guimeta says again, we've had this many times, but just to stress once more, the danger, always the Guimeta uses a different term for it, the danger of eating raw onions. Eating raw onions is as bad for the body as a person who sticks swords into the body. That's how bad and dangerous it is. And this, of course, we have many times in the Guimeta that says that raw onions are that dangerous they can even prove fatal, Chas v'Shalom. The Rabbeinu Zal warned about this. The Baal Shem HaKadosh said, too, that raw onions should never be eaten, even on Shabbat. You might think that Shabbat will protect the person. It is not so. They should not be eaten at any time. Onions can be eaten only if they are cooked. The Guimeta tells us an interesting case now where a boat, a liner, docked the port. The people got off this boat. And three people got off carrying one package, one suitcase. Two men and a woman. Now, at this port, important city in Eretz Yisrael, aside from going through customs, there's also a Beit Din, a court of rabbis in this port. So when they came through, they were questioned naturally. Each one was questioned individually, in order. First man was questioned, was asked, who are you, and with whom are you traveling? He said, well, I am the owner of this suitcase. This woman is my wife. This man is my slave. Second man was asked, who are you? He said, first man was lying. Because actually, I am the owner of the suitcase. The woman is my wife. And this first man is my slave. Here the judges were paying attention to these claims. So they asked the woman, will you tell us? She said, certainly. The package is mine, and these two men are my slaves. The other says that how can we now, judge, find out who's telling the truth? What we are concerned with, though, is this woman free, or is she married? She got two men claiming that they are her husband. She claims they are her slaves. What about the package itself? The result of the decision is that this woman is to get a divorce from both of these men if she wants to collect her ketubah from this package, this suitcase, the values in that suitcase. If not, we have no fear or no doubt about her being married to them, because there's no proof whatsoever. We accept her word that she's not the wife of either one of them, so that if she refuses, she can just leave freely. The men can leave freely. The package remains in the court until they prove who the owner is. But if both are willing to give this woman a divorce, she can collect the ketubah, which is an average of $200, and the rest of the package remains in court until one of the three proves ownership. It's a unique case, but we see where the Guimeta has an answer for every case that exists. Now we go back to history, where the Guimeta tells us that King Yanai HaMelech, went out to a land called Kuchlit in the desert, and there he conquered 60 cities in battle. He was the king of the Jews during the time of the second Beit HaMikdash. When he returned, he was very happy, this victory, conquering 60 cities, and he called all the rabbis of the Guimeta in to join him in a feast of victory. Now this feast was not a mitzvah. The Guimeta says that a Jew who is very pure should never sit down, should never attend a party or a feast unless it is a sudat mitzvah. This was no war of mitzvah. It was a regular war, Melchemet HaRishut, and the feast being made here, this party, was no mitzvah, and therefore the rabbis should not have attended this party. But because of the flattery They fell victim to this characteristic of flattery. They wanted to flatter the king. They came to this party and attended it. At the party, he said to the rabbis, our forefathers used to eat salted items when they were working on the building of the Beit HaMikdash. They had no time to eat better food. Let us, in memory of our forefathers who built the Beit HaMikdash, also have that type of food now at this party. And they placed this cheaper type of food on tables of pure gold, and they ate there. Things were going along smoothly until there was one man present who the Gemara says was a joker, one who makes jokes, which is something the Gemara does not like, an evil heart, and one who is completely wicked. His name was Elazar ben Poida. And he said to the king, King Yene, you know that these rabbis are your enemies. They are against you because they feel that you are not actually fit to be king. They consider you a slave. You come from the family of the Chashmonaim, and there's a question of doubt as to whether you're actually from that family, you're a slave. You're certainly not from the family of King David, so they consider you unfit to be king. They are enemies. Yonai said to him, he fell for this evil talk and said, what should I do? How can I find out? This wicked man said, there's a way to test them. Take the crown of the Kohen Gadol, place it on your head, and see if they object. If they object, it'll show that they disrespect you. He did this. One of the rabbis arose and said to him, Yanai HaMeloch, King Yanai, it is enough that you have the crown of king. Leave the crown of Kohen Gadol to the family of Aaron HaKohen. Now, by the way, explanation for this is, the Gemara says that how did the Kohen Gadol wear that crown on his forehead if he has to wear tefillin? The Gemara answers there's room on a person's head for two things, for two pair of tefillin. Makom yesh berosh laniach shnei tefillin. There's room for two pair of tefillin, therefore the Kohen Gadol could wear both the tzitz, that's the crown, and the tefillin. However, in the case of Yanai, they said to him, you're going to be king, the crown of king, plus the crown of Kohen Gadol, you'll have no room for tefillin at all. So leave the crown of Kohen Gadol for the Kohanim. This made him very angry, and he turned now to this wicked advisor and said, what should I do to them? So they've shown that they are disrespectful. What should I do? He said, very simple, kill them. Kill every one of the rabbis in the Gemara. Every one of the rabbis present there. So Yonai asked, what about the Torah? What happens to the Torah if they're all dead? This evil man said, well, you have the Torah lying in the corner. There's a Sefer Torah. Whoever wants, let him learn it from here on in. Now, the Gemara says here, Yonai showed what an apikudas he was, because he accepted this statement, and despite the fact that the Torah, of course, was in the corner, but that's the written Torah. What happens to the Torah Shebal Peh, the oral Torah, which only the rabbis could teach? At that time, they did not have Gemarot written down. All the Torah Shebal Peh was studied orally. Yonai accepted this advice of this evil man, and he had every one of the rabbis killed, which means that there would be no more Torah Shebal Peh in existence today, not for the fact that one rabbi, the brother of his wife. Yonai's wife was a sister of Rabbi Shimon ben Shatach. He's the rabbi who had the 80 magicians wiped out, a long story. She hid her brother. He escaped. He hid out until there was peace. And then he brought the entire Torah back to its former level. Imagine how much Torah he had to know, that the Torah that is known came from his head. Only Torah is what he taught at that time when all the rabbis are wiped out. Now, there is a saying by Tosafot that the Gemara tells us about Rabbi Yochanan Kohen Gadol. Rabbi Yochanan was a Kohen Gadol. For 80 years he was good, tzaddik. Then he became a Rasha at the end of his life. Tosafot maintains that this King Yanai is that Yochanan Kohen Gadol. He is that one who turned evil, and this was the case where he turned evil. That's a statement of theory by Tosafot. Then we come to a important bit of information where the Gemara clearly details four categories of marriage, where with these, knowing these four, we can determine any kind of marriage possible that could ever happen, determine what the child will be. Where the child takes after the mother or the father, or what status a child has, every marriage falls into one of these four categories. First one is a case where the marriage, the kiddushim, are kasher, a purely legal marriage, which means a Jew marrying a Jew, or a Kohen marrying Israel. Kohen marrying Israel, that's a legal marriage. In that case, wherever the marriage is 100% kosher and legal, always the child follows the father, which means that if the Kohen marries a woman who is family of Israel, the child will be a Kohen. If a Israel marries a Kohenet, woman who comes from the daughter of a Kohen, the child will be a Israel. The child will always follow the father wherever the marriage is a legal one. Second possibility is where the marriage takes hold, but it is a sin it's a sinful marriage, but it's still legal. For example, if a Kohen marries a divorcee, he is committing a sin. It's forbidden for a Kohen to marry a divorcee, but if he does marry her, they are married. That marriage is chal, that means it takes effect. In that case, then the child will always take after the lower one of the two, the illegal one. So that, let's say, if a Kohen marries a divorcee, just as she is forbidden to marry a Kohen, so too are her children forbidden to marry a Kohen. Or another case would be where a mamzer is not allowed to marry a Jew, Yisrael. What if he does? The marriage takes complete effect. It's legal. But the result is that the child takes after the mamzer or mamzeret. If the father is a mamzer, the child will be a mamzer. If the mother is a mamzer, the child will also be a mamzer. So where the marriage is legal, but it is a sin, the child takes after the worse one of the two. Third possibility is where the marriage to him is illegal, but to others it is legal. He is not allowed to marry this person, but everyone else is allowed to. In that case, the child is automatically a mamzer. For example, a relative, close relative, where the sister or aunt, mother, so on, others could marry her. For him, it's illegal. For him, the marriage cannot take effect. Then the child is a mamzer. Fourth category is where the marriage takes no effect whatsoever. If he marries her, they're not married at all. In that case, the child follows the mother. For example, a Jew who marries a Goya, he marries her, but there's no real marriage. It cannot take effect. They are not married. They're living together, but not married, because there's no legality in that marriage. A Jew marries a Goya, or a Jewess marries a Goy. Where the marriage did not take effect, the child follows the mother. These are the four possible cases. There is no other possibility, so we can always determine the fate of the child by following these four rules, these four guiding rules that can always tell us what the child is. Now, let's We don't have to go repeat this entire thing again to get it clear in your mind. You simply listen to the tape again if you want to memorize it. Jimenez says now, it's a very big chidush. The worst category possible is that of mamzer, because a mamzer cannot purify himself. It is impossible ever for mamzer to lose that identity, no matter what he does, no matter what he or she does, mamzer or mamzeret. The question is only, is it possible for a mamzer to have, at least, mamzer, let's say, is a learned person, he was born a mamzer, it's not his fault, he's very religious, he knows he cannot do anything for himself, could he do something for his children? Because we said that mamzer's children take after their father. Could he purify his children? This, there's a machloket debate in the Gemara between Rabbi Tarfon and Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Tarfon says that there is a way for mamzer to purify his children, that Eliezer says there is not. What is that way? Rabbi Tarfon says that if a mamzer marries a shifcha kenanit, a non-Jewish maid, then the child born takes after the mother because she's a non-Jew. The result is there was no marriage, legal. It means that she takes after the mother. The result is that the child is a non-Jew or a maid or a slave. Now, how does a slave or a maid become a Jew? If the master frees him, he becomes a Jew automatically. So in this case, what a mamzer should do is to marry a maid, and then the child born have this maid or slave freed, and that the stigma of mamzer is off. He is no longer a slave or a maid. He has purified his child. Rabbi Eliezer says this cannot help, because he maintains that if a mamzer marries a maid, the child born is considered both a mamzer and a slave, both a mamzeret and a maid combined. That's the machloket. Interestingly, we go to the Shulchan Aruch, where the Bet Yosef tells us an additional chidush, to go even further than this law. The Tarfon was trying to help purify the children of a mamzer. He gave us one example. The Bet Yosef adds a second one.